Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Dr. Alice Aiken, a professor in the School of Rehabilitation Therapy at Queen's University. And we're going to talk about veterans' benefits, the new plan to administer lump sum benefits to veterans with disabilities as opposed to the older plan still in effect for previously disabled veterans that provided them with a pension. Alice, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I read the article which mentioned your name in the Globe and Mail. It was on the problem with the new benefits shortchanging veterans. And the article didn't address how veterans qualify directly, but I gather there's at least two sets of problems. One is the level of reward that they get under the new system, and the other is the ease of qualifying for rewards in the new system.
Right. Well, what we looked at specifically was those people who are deemed seriously disabled veterans. And what that means from Veterans Affairs Canada is somebody who has a disability assessment of 78% or greater.
Right.
So 78 to 100% disabled. And that's basically what we looked at to qualify the financial remuneration that these people would receive from Veterans Affairs. And we compared the old act, which is called the Pension Act, to what veterans are covered have been covered under since 2006, which is called the New Veterans Charter.
And I take it there are quite a number of veterans still being paid under the old act.
That's correct. If you were pensioned under the Pension Act, you still receive your pension from the Pension Act.
All right.
And you are entitled to any of the benefits under the New Veterans Charter that weren't available under the Pension Act.
Obviously not the lump sum.
No, not the financial benefits, but the programming.
Oh, okay, good. So is there programming for both, or is the programming for the new act replace the programming for the old?
There is programming for both.
Okay.
And so whichever would be more beneficial, if you were pensioned under the Pension Act, whichever would be more beneficial for you, you're entitled to.
Okay. So I gather that what was available under the Pension Act is not available to people who qualified after 2006.
That's correct.
All right. And this poses a problem for veterans.
Well, it does for the seriously disabled veterans, and I have to qualify my remarks to that group because we didn't do an analysis for the non-seriously disabled veterans.
All right.
So it certainly does financially pose a... If they at the end of the day, they don't get enough money.
Okay.
Or as much money.
All right.
And the other thing is that they are not... under the Pension Act... Your family situation was taken into account. So if you had a spouse, you got more money per month. And if you had children, you got more money per month.
Oh, and the lump sum doesn't take that into account.
The lump sum does not take that into account.
Oh, okay.
The other big financial difference is that the programs available under the New Veterans Charter are all taxable, where the programs under the Pension Act are not taxable.
That's a hell of a difference. Pardon
me. It does make a big difference.
Yeah.
The other big differences are that with the Pension Act there was a survivor benefit. So if the veteran passed away, their spouse received a portion of their pension for the rest of their life.
Right.
They're obviously with a lump sum, you can't do that, and any of the other benefits are directly tied to the veteran. So there is nothing, if the veteran passes away, there is no ongoing money for the spouse.
Is there any money to relieve the hardship of the passing away, the funeral expenses, the disruption, and the costs?
That's a good question, Jeff. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But there was, for sure, under the old system, there was a survivor benefit.
Well, it's not a survivor benefit. It's that the pension continues, a portion of the pension continues.
Right.
So it wasn't a lump sum when the person passed away. You just continued to get a portion of their tax-free pension.
Okay. And again, provisions for interment or anything, or services or anything like
again,
that?
Again, I'm not sure on that.
Okay.
Yeah, we sort of didn't look at that. We looked at what would be considered the disability benefits per se.
And what did you find when you looked at the disability benefit?
Well, what we found is that at the end of the day, for a seriously disabled veteran, they end up receiving less money. And the things that penalized them were living longer. So, because you continue to get your, under the Pension Act, you continue to get your tax-free pension as long as you live.
Right.
A lump sum payment is just that. And unfortunately, for most of the benefits under the new Veterans Charter, they cease to be in existence once you turn 65 and start receiving CPP.
Oh, I see.
So after age 65, you
So they didn't before. You had a special set of benefits that applied to veterans, but now it's the same benefits that apply to civilians.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, after age 65. I mean, you get veterans benefits up to age 65, but not after.
Right.
Under the new Pension Act. The other thing is that it's now tied to rank as well. So even for the same disability, a higher-ranking person would get a higher payout, which is very similar to what insurance companies do because it's based on potential earning. However, I'm sure we could all argue that a corporal who loses both legs in the service of his country should not be penalized because of his rank compared to, say, a colonel who loses both his legs in the service of his country. So,
my understanding is that the old system at least rewarded the recipient according to their pay, but the new one rewards them according to their rank.
No, the old system rewarded them according to their disability.
Oh,
it had nothing to do with rank or pay.
Okay.
It rewarded them according to their disability. So,
a general and a corporal would get the same compensation for the same disability.
For the same disability, whereas now they would not. The general would get significantly more because he's a higher rank.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Are you in a position to comment on what the motivation behind the change is?
I am really not in a position to comment on that. The government said it was a more comprehensive package,
mm-hmm.
and indeed there are more programs available to the average veteran who's not seriously disabled.
Okay.
However, the problem is that if a veteran is seriously disabled, they are financially disadvantaged.
Yeah.
And often they can't take part in the programs. The focus of the new Veterans Charter is to get people back to work.
Right.
Well, there's some seriously disabled people who are not going to get back to work. They can't take advantage of a re-education program or anything like that.
And your perception is that this new lump sum plan disadvantages them by offering them, in two ways. One, by offering them programs they can't use, and number two, by paying them less than they would have gotten.
Right, overall, over the life course, it doesn't appear to care for seriously disabled veterans as well.
How long has this been in effect?
It came in 2006 with the idea that the new veteran has different needs. The new veteran from Afghanistan, etc., and from peacekeeping has different needs than the World War II veteran.
Yeah.
Which on the surface is exactly true. The World War II veteran is obviously going to be much older now and have different needs with respect to hearing and things than a young veteran would have. And because the majority of the people being injured in Afghanistan are very young, potentially if the injury is not serious, they can take advantage of a lot of the programs under the new Veterans Charter.
I see.
Yeah, the problem arises when somebody is seriously disabled.
Who funded your study?
A group called the Canadian Disability Policy Alliance.
Right.
And that's funding through the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada.
Okay.
So that's one of the big three granting agencies in the country.
And who funds them?
The government.
Okay. So are they pleased with your study? Are they questioning your study? Are they doing anything since the results of your study became clear?
Not the granting agency per se. That's not their mandate.
No.
Their mandate is to fund original research, which is what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea if Veterans Affairs is going to act on our study or not. They have asked me for a copy of the full report.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they want to look at it.
They do want to look at it, yes.
Okay.
They've done a similar study themselves. It came out just after our article came out.
What did their study find?
Same thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, yeah. At least you're not at loggerheads over the results of the study and the effects on the veterans.
Right. And what they found was not the exact same values that we found in any financial analysis. You have to make certain assumptions.
Right.
And so we worked with a health economist and made, you know, we didn't take into account inflation and various things, but all with the eye to just making it as equitable as we could. And, you know, they basically found the same things that we found.
And now for a short break, Winoni Harris and Dig This Boogie. You've been listening to Professor Alice Aiken at the School of Rehabilitation Therapy at Queen's University, talking about benefits for severely disabled veterans.
So what are the mechanisms for bringing about change? I would imagine this is probably pretty deeply enmeshed in government policy, the mechanisms for changing something like this. And it's not like a civilian issue where the veterans can walk off the job and threaten a strike and that sort of thing. Mm. What are the mechanisms for change here for advancing the viewpoint that you and the Veterans Affairs have arrived at almost at the same time?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I couldn't pretend to know what drives government policy.
Right.
And I think that what we've seen is some good evidence that hopefully the government can use. The whole thing about the new Veterans Charter is it was designed to be a living charter. That is Veterans Affairs words. It's designed to be a living charter so it can respond to the needs of veterans quickly. They themselves established a working group called the New Veterans Group Advisory Council, or the New Veterans Charter Advisory Council or Advisory Group.
Okay.
And they looked at the charter and made recommendations to the government because it's meant to be a living charter, and this was part of their mandate. And to date, they've made numerous recommendations. I believe the number is about 14.
Since the legislation was passed.
Exactly. And the government has not acted on any of them.
That's disturbing.
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what they mean by a living charter, then, if they're not going to act on recommendations from their own committee.
Right. I understand it's also difficult to qualify for some of the benefits that are provided for in the new Veterans Charter.
Yeah, there's one in particular that we did include in our analysis. It's called the Permanent Impairment Allowance.
Right.
But to date, out of 20,000, a little over 20,000 veterans who have qualified for pensions, only 16 have qualified for this Permanent Impairment Allowance.
And you're not saying 16,000, you're saying 16.
16, yep. Yeah. 16 people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What's happened to the other 19,984 people?
Well, you would only have qualified for a permanent impairment allowance if you were seriously disabled.
Right.
And so I believe the number for seriously disabled under the new Veterans Charter is a little over 1,000.
Okay.
So the percentages aren't that bad. I mean, they would be the only ones ever even considered for it. But still, only 16.
When you say the number's over 1,000, what are we talking about? What does the number represent?
That's the number of seriously disabled veterans.
Oh, I see.
Those are the people who are injured greater than 80%.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
78%.
Does your study make any comment on who they feel should qualify?
No. The Veterans Affairs, like every insurance company, has their own determination criteria for...
Right.
The extent of your disability.
But your determination is that 1,000 people are seriously injured.
That's their determination.
Oh, their determination.
Those numbers are not seriously enough,
is what it comes down to, right?
Pardon me?
But not seriously enough to qualify for this.
That's right. So they are disabled 78% or greater,
right.
But they don't believe that they qualify for this permanent impairment allowance. Only 16 of them so far.
Really?
Yeah.
So what happens to those, you know, like I say, 984 people then?
Well, they got their lump sum, and they are entitled to the other benefits, but this one small portion called permanent impairment allowance, which is a portion that keeps going through life,
yeah.
They are not entitled to.
Is there another equivalent in the old plan? I guess the whole program was the equivalent before, right?
Well,
in the sense that everybody got the pension throughout life.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, so the seriously disabled veteran would still get a lump sum and be entitled to numerous other benefits. It's just this one portion called a permanent impairment allowance that they weren't entitled to.
Yeah.
That nobody's been entitled to.
So this is a distinction that's new since 2006.
It's new, yes. And under the old Veterans Charter, people just received pension for life, a tax-free pension for life.
Regardless of the level of disability, yeah.
Right, but I mean the amount of the pension was contingent upon their level of disability.
Right.
But that was, yeah.
Now the receipt of the pension is contingent on the level of disability, and apparently the level has to be unbelievably high.
Like for a lump sum payout, depending on what your... I think the maximum started at $250,000 when they started this,
right.
And it's gone up every year for inflation. So it sits somewhere around the maximum amount for 100% disability that you can get is somewhere around $276,000 as a lump sum payout.
Right. But I was talking about qualifying for the permanent impairment.
I'm going to reiterate to you, extremely high. Right. But I'll reiterate to you is only a very it's only a portion of the total benefits within the new Veterans Charter.
Right, so these people still get the lump sum, but it's the 16 who qualify who get the ongoing lifelong benefit.
Which is a small part. Now, there are other ongoing benefits that the 1,000 of them would be getting,
right.
Just not this one small one called the permanent impairment allowance.
Is that the full extent of the permanent impairment allowance? Is an ongoing benefit on top of all the other opportunities? I say all the other opportunities. I have no doubt that these guys can't take advantage of them. But everybody gets the same treatment except the 16 who qualify for the permanent impairment get an additional chunk.
Every month
for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's it. That's all they get that's different from everybody else.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
The amount they got may have been different, too, initially, depending on their level of impairment and their rank.
Yeah, okay. All right. Is it is it reasonable of me to ask if you find it disturbing that that's the only difference someone who's permanently impaired gets for the rest of their life? The only difference is they get a little more money for the rest of their life, and everybody else, including the people who are probably very closely impaired to that level, don't qualify for that. Is it on either side? It strikes me as disturbing that the distinction is so small, and yet the number who are excluded seems so large. They're two different points of view, but neither one seems to favor the new program.
Certainly in terms of financial compensation, again, for seriously disabled veterans, it's not a great financial program.
Yeah, and it would strike me that the programs for veterans who are not permanently impaired or near it would be nothing like the programs that somebody who is seriously disabled would need.
Yeah, correct. And now the vast majority of veterans are not seriously disabled,
really?
Obviously.
Oh, really?
Right, because okay. We've got the 19,000 who are not considered seriously disabled by Veterans Affairs standards. Right, there's 1,000 who are seriously disabled.
Right.
And then there's the 19,000 pension.
95%, yeah.
Yeah. So that group is, you know, has access to programs that they may or may not be able to use.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But then we have this group in the middle, right? This 1,000 who don't qualify for the permanent impairment benefit but are seriously disabled.
Correct.
And nothing distinguishes their benefits except perhaps an increment of payment in the lump sum.
Exactly, correct, yes. Yeah.
And I find that disturbing. I'll be quite frank with you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was your study's mandate to comment and whether that's disturbing or not. Clearly, you've not heard from Veterans Affairs that they find that disturbing. It must be disturbing for the veterans.
It is certainly disturbing for the seriously disabled veterans, yes.
Well, I mean, for any veteran who realizes the risk that he's taking on and going overseas into armed combat, it must be disturbing to realize that serious disability carries with it unique burdens and unique restrictions, but very few unique opportunities.
Yeah, correct. And I think that we ask a lot of our men and women who serve in the Canadian Forces without a really good mechanism to support them if something happens.
Yeah.
And you know, I will tell you that I believe everybody who has served in the Canadian Forces deserves respect and support from this country.
Right.
And I don't know if you know, but even the regular Canadian Forces pension that you get after you serve 25 years,
right,
as soon as you start receiving CPP, is clawed back by the amount of CPP. So unlike other jobs, if you work at, I don't know, a Canadian company, Bombardier, and you get a pension, I don't know if they have a pension plan, but if you work at Bombardier and you get a pension, when you turn 65, you start getting CPP, your pension's not clawed back.
That's right.
But if you served in the military and you receive a pension from the Treasury Board when you turn 60, and that's all people who've served, when you turn 65 and start receiving CPP, your pension is clawed back by the amount of CPP.
Yeah.
So that's a broader issue. That was not within the scope of our study, but that is something that veterans have been protesting for quite some time.
So for people who revere the military and the job that they do for us all in Canada, mm-hmm. Where's the place to express their dissatisfaction with this reward for the disabled military particularly?
Yeah.
And all the military who share that risk. What avenue can you recommend that they would take?
Well,
or are you comfortable with that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm a policy researcher, and
right.
I don't know how you.
Have you seen any effective protest of these provisions? Because I know the objections to it have been going on for some time.
Well, and there has been a concerted effort to protest. I know that the vast majority of the pension groups protested. The Legion has been actively involved in protesting the new Veterans Charter. Many, many veterans groups have been.
So, get involved with your veterans group then would be one way to protest this charter.
Absolutely,
it would.
You know, and go to your MP. Write a letter to your MP.
Right.
This is federal policy. You know, sit in your MP's office if you know your MP. Talk to them.
All right.
Say this is unfair. This has to change. You know, we're on the cusp of an election.
Yes,
I know. And the military is very popular right now. I think for
That's
a long
true.
Time the military was not, and so, but you know, politically now people. the military's front and center, and people see what our the men and women in our Canadian forces do, and they're very supportive of the troops.
Well, and what they're capable of. They're quite capable. It's surprised a lot of Canadians how capable they are, even on a limited budget.
Always have been, yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think that there is definitely something to talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people recognize the value of our Canadian forces now.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to make a stand, talk to your MP. It's the best way to go about it.
All right, on that recommendation, is there anything that you have not said that you would like to say before we close the interview?
Well, I want to say that, you know, our study had a very specific focus.
Right.
And some of the protests we've seen in the... If you go online at in the Globe and Mail, people have written responses, some very obviously from Veterans Affairs, to say that there are numerous new programs that are better for veterans. And they do have a lot of new programs in the new Veterans Charter, and there are some that are very innovative and good for not seriously disabled veterans. But for the seriously disabled veteran, the financial compensation and the problems with the financial compensation is so overwhelming that I think they would have a hard time taking advantage of all the new programs.
And not to upstage your final comment, but that probably implies emotional and family consequences along with the financial consequences too, doesn't it?
Indeed. All indeed right. It does, yeah.
Thank you for your time, Alice. And thank you for your point of view.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
All right, thanks again.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Professor Alice Aiken at the School of Rehabilitation Therapy at Queen's University, talking about benefits for severely disabled veterans. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the full stories from the newspapers that we read to you, but edited or condensed versions from the papers that we mention in the broadcast. And the news story that sparked our interview this week, Ottawa slow to act on veterans' concerns. The Royal Canadian Legion was behind the new veterans' charter because they were told it was a living charter that would be amended as flaws or gaps were identified. At least 13 such flaws were identified by the new veterans' charter advisory group, of which the Legion is a member, in October 2009. To date, none has been fixed. The political will to make improvements for veterans and their families is not there. These include 5 changes to family support services, 4 improvements for the financial security of veterans, and 4 recommendations to improve rehabilitation services for wounded veterans. Among the 4 improvements concerning financial security is an option to receive disability awards in a structured settlement versus a lump sum payment. For example, in Australia and the United Kingdom, more is paid out in lump sums for injuries, and an injured veteran in Australia has the option of taking a lump sum payment or having it spread out over a period of time. Parliament's own Standing Committee on Veterans Affairs and the new Veterans Charter Advisory Group agree with the Australian approach of giving veterans the option of how they collect sums allocated for a disability. Why does that option not exist here, when it has been recommended to the government? And why does Veterans Affairs not fund veterans' healthcare research issues as its American counterpart does? Why has no consideration been given to the increase in cost of health services as our veterans grow older? I do not see the transparency promised to veterans, nor do I see the consultation processes promised to veterans' organizations. What I do see is an erosion of the benefits promised to the people who join our armed forces. What we need right now is a department and the budget to care for those who return wounded, visibly and invisibly, and their families. Canada's responsibility to our service people is at risk. It is time for the federal government to act to eliminate that risk. Nicholas Paphaitis, Associated Press, from Thessaloniki, Greece. Greeks march against cutbacks. Some 20,000 people gathered in 3 separate protests in the northern port city of Thessaloniki ahead of Prime Minister George Papandreou's speech. They were accompanied by 4,500 police on security duty. No arrests or injuries were reported. On Saturday, an elderly man threw a shoe at Pape Andreu, who had just inaugurated an annual trade fair. The shoe landed wide of its target. The alleged shoe thrower was arrested, but later freed as Pape Andreu declined to press charges. He also pledged to open up restricted professions, including truck drivers, notaries, taxi drivers, and pharmacists, deregulate the energy market, settle on privatization targets, and simplify business licensing procedures by the end of this year. Around 600 truck owners marched on Saturday morning to protest the planned deregulation of their profession. The center-left government says its daunting task of reducing the budget deficit from 13% of annual output in 2009 to 8.1% this year is on track, and is pledged to maintain the pace. Toronto Star, Tuesday, September 7th, Petty Fong, Western Canada Bureau, major HST crisis awaits BC Premier. The discord over the HST, which BC's Liberal government announced it was bringing in weeks after winning its third term, has plagued Premier Gordon Campbell and Minister Colin Hanson for the past year and dominated political discussion this summer. Documents released under Freedom of Information legislation show that Hanson received briefing notes about the HST weeks before the election, which the Liberals won handily in May 2009. It was only after the election, Hanson and Campbell insist, that they decided they should follow Ontario in bringing in the tax. Polls show most British Columbians don't believe him, and the Liberals have seen their support plummet to near record lows. The HST issues enters yet another stage when a legislative committee meets to discuss a 700,000-signature petition gathered under the leadership of former Premier Bill Vanderzam, urging the government to turf the tax. Deaths of nine prisoners similar to Ashley's watchdog. Diana Zlomislik in The Star. Since Ashley Smith's disturbing death inside a Kitchener segregation cell, Canada's prison watchdog told The Star he has discovered nine similar fatalities that question the correctional service's willingness to stop jailhouse suicides. Smith, 19, strangled herself with a piece of cloth on October 19, 2007, while incarcerated at Grand Valley Institute as seven guards watched. Senior prison officials had ordered staff to keep their distance as long as Smith appeared to be breathing. With a coroner's inquest into Ashley Smith's death scheduled to start in November, Howard Safers, correctional services investigator, told The Star he feels strongly that the process should examine her entire experience in the adult correctional system. Ontario's deputy chief coroner, Dr. Benita Porter, had earlier ruled that the inquest should focus on the last 13 weeks of Smith's life, which she served in the province. Smith's family argues that Porter's inquest must consider the 11 months preceding the teen's death, which drove her to suicidal despair, and Safers agrees. Court and prison documents obtained by The Star show how the young woman's complaints of inhumane treatment were repeatedly ignored and how she wound up a caged animal 4 years after first entering the correctional system for throwing crab apples at a postal worker. In federal custody, Smith was shuttled through 17 institutions across four provinces in the last year of her life alone. Sapers revealed that there are issues in the Smith case that merit closer scrutiny, issues that he wasn't able to delve into in his own report. It has only recently come to light, he said, that Smith was given psychotropic drugs against her will while she was held at a Quebec prison. Last week, Porter agreed to let the family's lawyer submit written arguments supporting a motion to broaden the inquest scope, but she also issued a rare sealing order on all of the information, meaning the family's arguments and any supporting evidence will never enter the public domain. When Crown Attorney Andre Rajna dropped all charges against Kitchener prison employees in late 2008 with little explanation, Sapers said his hope of a greater public understanding vanished. I'm concerned that the scope of the inquest will be so narrow, Sigbert said, that opportunity may be lost as well. Saturday, September 4th, Toronto Star, Thomas Walkham. School fees are slowly eroding public education. As a shocking report demonstrates, the subtle privatization of public education in Ontario continues apace. This is not the overt privatization proposed so unsuccessfully by the Tory government of Ernie Eves. Rather, as the People for Education report demonstrates, it's privatization by stealth. The mechanism is simple. School funding has gradually squeezed until parents find themselves compelled to pay out of pocket for critical elements of their children's education, like textbooks or lab equipment. Schools in areas where families tend to be well off can raise the money needed. Schools in areas where families are poor cannot. Even with individual schools, children may be sorted by income. About 16% of Ontario high schools now charge user fees for basic language courses like French. About 13% charge out-of-pocket user fees to children who want to study science. As the Star's Kristen Rashoe reported, a Niagara area board has been charging fees to kids who want to use the school library. Both the Premier and his education minister, Leona Dombrowski, call this situation unacceptable, yet both blithely accept it. McGuinty said that his government hopes to eventually put in place guidelines for school user fees. His government has been saying the same thing since 2005. The People for Education report found that more than half of all Ontario schools must now resort to fundraising to pay for basic classroom supplies, textbooks, and library books. A smaller but increasing number of schools have to raise funds privately to carry out necessary repairs and renovations. It is, as the Premier stated, unacceptable. But because his government does nothing, the unacceptable continues. The Globe and Mail. Andrew Picard, public health reporter. Universal pharmacare touted as way to save billions. Canadians cannot afford not to have universal pharmacare, said Marc-André Gagnon, an assistant professor in the School of Public Policy at Carleton University in Ottawa. He said consumers would be better served by a national drug pricing and drug policies aimed at improving access and affordability rather than the current approach, where the desire to attract investment in the pharmaceutical sector inflates prices. A 120-page paper prepared for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives argues that countries with national pharmacare programs such as the UK, France, Australia, New Zealand, and Sweden all have lower drug prices. Currently, prices are established by the Patented Medicines Prices Review Board based on the median price in seven other countries. In the paper, Professor Gagnon argues that while the process ensures consistency, it also keeps drug prices artificially high because its formula includes the four countries with the most expensive prices in the world. National Post, no date, but this week, Tom Blackwell, lower prices may backfire, generic firms. Generic drug companies are warning that a growing push by provinces to lower the price of generic medicines could seriously backfire, making it unfeasible for manufacturers to produce some no-name drugs or mount expensive court challenges of brand-name patents. The result could be hundreds of millions of dollars in added costs for governments and consumers as higher-priced brand-name pills hang on to their patent protection for months or years longer than generic businesses charge. The industry called for changes to a federal patent system they call unfair, incentives from the provinces for generic companies to challenge drug patents, and wider recognition that the current system redirects much of their revenue to pharmacies. There is very limited opportunity now to make a profit, and certainly very little opportunity to make enough of a profit to take these risks, said Jim Keon, president of the Canadian Generic Pharmaceutical Association. What we're going to see is a very conservative industry taking fewer risks and generics coming to market later. Is that a good bargain? Said Jack Kay, president of Apotex, the country's largest generic company. If I have to compete on price only, I will have to shift my manufacturing to a lower-cost jurisdiction, which is either India or China, he said. However, a spokesman for brand-name companies strongly rejected the generic arguments. Russell Williams, president of Canada's research-based pharmaceutical companies, the Brand Trade Association, argued that if anything, the brand name industry needs more protection from the patent system, especially given that it is increasingly making drugs that will target much smaller populations of patients, meaning lower sales. One analyst said the generic industry has generally little to complain about. Even the lower prices recently mandated by provinces like Ontario are higher than if Canada had a free market for generic drugs like in the U.S., said Mark Rovere of the Fraser Institute, a conservative think tank. They're still doing better than they would in a free market. And now a short break. Devel Crawford, keep it rolling. Mail, Gloria Galloway in St. John's, Newfoundland. Newfoundland is joining Saskatchewan in funding studies of a controversial therapy for multiple sclerosis, leaving behind the more cautious federal approach that has so far been mimicked by the other provinces. Health Minister Jerome Kennedy stepped out of a meeting with his provincial and territorial counterparts on Monday to announce that his government would devote funds to monitor Newfoundland patients who pay to have liberation therapy performed in countries where it is allowed. None of the other health ministers were prepared to launch similar studies. It was a conversation with a St. John's lawyer whose own multiple sclerosis symptoms significantly decreased after he underwent liberation therapy that convinced Mr. Kennedy to ask neurologists whether something could be gained by examining people who have had the treatment. Mr. Kennedy said it's clear that all the provinces are very concerned about finding an answer to the question of whether or not the Zamboni procedure works, he said, but at the end of the day, each province will take steps that look after their own citizens, and this is what I am doing here. Again, from the Globe and Mail, Medical Catch 22. This is the chicken and egg question that this country's 75,000 multiple sclerosis patients are up against. The Zamboni treatment, which involves the dilation of blocked veins with balloon catheters, is unproven. To prove its value would require clinical studies that apparently cannot be done because the treatment is unproven. But another approach is possible. The State University of New York at Buffalo received ethics approval to establish the safety of the treatment in a 10-patient lead-in trial in June. We had absolutely no issues whatsoever, Nick Hopkins, the chairman of the neurosurgery department, said on Monday. The university will soon enroll 20 patients in a preliminary treatment study. Only those who have been identified in imaging tests as having vein abnormalities will be candidates. The university previously did a study that found those blockages more common in MS patients than in those who do not have MS. A similar study is being done in Hamilton. Canadian health ministers should consider a question posed by Dr. Hopkins. Quote, if you say we're not going to study it, how are you ever going to learn? Unquote. Toronto Star, September 9th, 2010. Diabetes-related costs staggering, report says. James Poisson, staff reporter. Diabetes is costing Ontario $4.9 billion per year, according to the Canadian Diabetes Association. Direct costs, such as hospital and doctor visits, account for about 22% of the total, while indirect costs, such as lost productivity and disability payments for those too sick to work, make up the rest. Carolyn Cummins, a scientist with the University of Toronto who specializes in diabetes research, said complications arising from diabetes, such as heart disease and blindness, will put a strain on the healthcare system as well. The association recommends government focus on three things: targeting at-risk populations, prevention, and working to prevent complications of the disease. President and CEO of the Diabetes Association, Michael Cloutier, said one in four Ontarians will be living either with diabetes or pre-diabetes by 2020, adding that turning the tide will require a significant change in government and private sector approaches, as well as sweeping changes in attitudes. And again, the Toronto Star, Joseph Hall, health reporter. Doctors lacking in pain education. Canadian doctors are woefully undertrained in pain management and addiction, which is contributing to Ontario's prescription narcotics crisis, says the body that regulates the province's doctors. Medical schools in this country devote a meager 16 hours on average to proper pain education, half of the training nurses receive, and less than one-fifth the time that veterinary schools devote to the subject. In a sweeping set of recommendations aimed at stemming epidemic abuse of narcotics like OxyContin, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario is urging beefed-up academic training in pain relief and addiction. The report also recommends that new federal guidelines on the safe and effective use of opioids for chronic, non-cancer-related pain should be considered the gold standard in all educational programs. The college is also supporting a provincial strategy announced by the Ontario Health Ministry, calling for a system that would track all narcotics dispensing at the drugstore counter. But the college went further, recommending the creation of electronic tracking records for all drugs sold in the province. It also calls on the province to create a string of pain relief clinics across Ontario that would specialize in the proper use of narcotics and management alternatives. Our story for next week, Who Decides When You Die? Robert Cribb, staff reporter at The Star, September 4th. As her father lay struggling for breath in a Toronto hospital bed, Joy Warziniak pleaded with doctors to intervene and save his life. While Wozniak and her father, Douglas Du Deguerre, had repeatedly requested he receive life-saving treatment in case of a medical emergency, doctors unilaterally overruled those wishes without consent or consultation. She claims in a $1 million lawsuit filed against Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center and two doctors responsible for her father's care. The allegations, which have not been proved in court, set the stage for renewed public debate over the largely unsettled ethical and legal questions surrounding end-of-life protocols in Canada, experts say. The million-dollar question at the heart of this is whether it is a medical decision or a family patient decision, says Dr. Carrie Bowman, a bioethicist at the University of Toronto who teaches end-of-life issues and has helped negotiate disputes between doctors and their family. That question has largely been unanswered from an ethical and legal perspective in this country. The two doctors named in the suit, Martin Chapman and Donald Livingstone, did not respond to interview requests from the Star. As her father was fading away, Wozniak, a registered nurse in Oshawa, made her own desperate attempt to save him, grabbing his respiratory bag and squeezing it while using her other hand to call a hospital operator and beg for help to be sent, she said in the statement of claim and in an interview with the Star. Wozniak alleges Chapman, one of the doctors standing in the room, said, "Nobody will come." No one did. Soon after, her 88-year-old father, recovering from surgery in which both his legs were amputated, lurched slightly forward and died. "He wanted to live," Wozniak said in an interview. "He was a fighter. He made it through the war. He said, 'I haven't come this far to give up now.' They were playing God." Barry Squadron, the Toronto lawyer representing Wozniak, said her suit could set legal precedent in Canada. In 2007, Deguerre appointed his daughter his substitute decision-maker. The following year, he was admitted to Lakeridge Health in Ottawa, Oshawa. In meetings with doctors, he and his daughter expressed their wishes that he be treated as full code, hospital parlance meaning a patient is to be resuscitated in the event of a cardiac or respiratory arrest, the claim alleges. A progress note written by his doctor in Oshawa reads, "Refused code status, and the patient's daughter and patient said they wish to have the full code continued," says the statement of claim. 4 months after, Deguerre was transferred to Sunnybrook's K-Wing, a care facility for veterans. His condition deteriorated. Surgery was required to amputate his legs above the knee. While in recovery from the surgery, a report in his chart for September 18, 2008, 4 days before he died, reads, "Patient is now full code," the statement claims. Over the next 3 days, Deguerre's hospital chart includes three more references reaffirming the full code order. On September 22nd, the day Deguerre died, the instructions in his hospital chart changed without warning, the claim alleges. Unbeknownst to Deguerre or the plaintiff, and without lawful authority, Livingston and Chapman changed Deguerre's status from full code to do not resuscitate. A copy of the chart for that day includes two notes, apparently signed by the two doctors, giving a do not resuscitate order. Chapman, the suit alleges, told Wozniak, "This is for his own good." That, she says, was his opinion. "Are we going to take people's rights away and let doctors decide who lives and dies? It was only hours after we discussed his code that they turned around and reversed it." Dr. Howard Brody, a medical ethicist and director of the Institute for the Medical Humanities at the University of Texas in Galveston, says doctors who feel their professional integrity prevents them from following the patient's or family's wishes are ethically obliged to be upfront with the family. Wozniak says that never happened in the case of her father. She filed a complaint with the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons that did not result in disciplinary action. The matter is currently under appeal, she says. The 61-year-old says she understands her father was elderly and wouldn't live forever, and she would not protest his death if reasonable steps had been made to help him, she says. "I'm not unreasonable, but to cut him off because he was weak and needed help and support with his breathing? I couldn't believe this was happening. He died before my eyes, and they just stood there." And from the Toronto Star, our top news story, Oslo. No credit. A Norwegian radio journalist quit on the air after complaining about her job and saying she wouldn't read the day's news because nothing important has happened anyway. Pia Beatha Peterson accused her employers at the regional radio station of public broadcaster NRK of putting too much pressure on the staff. Peterson said in the live Saturday broadcast that she was quitting and walking away because she wanted to be able to eat properly again and be able to breathe. The disgruntled 43-year-old ended her nearly two-minute announcement by saying there wouldn't be any news on Saturday. NRK spokesman Øyvind Werner Ofsti says Peterson's actions were a surprise. And that's really all the news that we have for you this week at Disrespect, but come back next week. We will have more. To take us out, something special, Dick Davis, the Screaming Boogie. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.